When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, and we are back. This is Drew Taylor. I should tell everyone that. Joined, as always, by Charles Hood.
Hello.
We are back with an episode from the archives, Charles.
Yes.
A lost gem, and we are so excited to bring this one to you because this is one of...
And it's no longer lost. It's not lost.
It's no longer lost. No.
We found it. It's here for you to enjoy and listen to.
It is.
And also, you know, with our old bringing back our back catalog, if you notice, we also are bringing back Kevin Blumenfeld's Legally Dissimilar Light the Fuse theme. So with these old episodes, when you hear them, you'll hear, a nice throwback to Kevin Blumenfeld's original Light the Fuse theme, which is Legally Dissimilar from the Mission Impossible theme.
Yeah, it cleared in the eyes of Paramount and God above. It is Legally Dissimilar. This is, I think I speak for both of us, one of our favorite interviews ever.
Yes.
It's just delightful, and I hope you guys love it as much as we do. We are talking this week to Brian De Palma and Susan Lehman, who is his creative and romantic partner. They wrote a book together called Are Snakes Necessary that Charles and myself both read and adored, and so we were so thrilled to kind of grab them while they were promoting that book and talk about everything else. And you will hear in the interview as we slowly charm our way into De Palma's heart, I think. Would you say that's what happened?
Yeah. Yes, I would. Yeah. And then this was recorded back in, I think, June 2021. And this coincided with the first Mission Impossible movie's 25th anniversary, which was in 2021. So that was really amazing to talk to him around that time. And, get the book if you're a De Palma fan, because you're going to love it. Are Snakes Necessary?
Yeah, it is. It is basically a De Palma movie in book form. Twists, yeah. Turns, weird sex. It's got it all. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're just so happy to bring this interview back. I mean, just hearing that amazing George Lucas story about how he contributed to the first Mission Impossible is still one of my favorite things that we ever unearthed. It's just so cool. And we get into so many of De Palma's movies from his storied career. So it's just so great to get into that. And also one of our favorite things, I believe we get another dog interruption in here, which is always welcome on our show.
Oh, yes. And again, you know, I feel like we were sort of the dog as well. He sort of seems annoyed by the dog, but you can tell that he loves the dog. And I feel like that by the end of this episode, we achieved the same status. So,
okay. Yeah. I don't think we quite made it to the level of the dog, but maybe we're like the neighbor's dog or something.
Yeah, but that's always what we aspire to be.
Yes.
Dog worthy. And Charles, I want to remind people that they can watch all six of the original Mission Impossible movies, including Brian De Palma's original masterpiece, right now on Paramount Plus. And also that you can buy Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning from your favorite digital provider as well as on physical media. And that would be DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K Ultra HD disc, which you and I have and love that release. So go get it. It's great. So let's get into Brian De Palma. Charles had a great question about the title of the book he wanted to ask.
Yeah, I did. So Are Snakes Necessary? Is that a reference to the Preston Sturges movie, The Lady Eve? Because he's, Henry Fonda's reading the book. And I'd love to hear what the reasoning behind that was.
It's a good title.
I mean, yeah, the title works really well for this story. Are you a fan? Are you a big fan of that movie? Or was it just literally you just saw that title and liked it and thought it fit?
I've seen all those Preston Sturges movies. And that's like the first shot. He's reading this book on a deck chair on a yacht.
The title made me laugh. All right, let's I'll book that.
Well, do we have another title ever?
No.
No. Okay.
Well, I was going to ask if this was ever, you know, conceived as a movie, but it sounds like it was always a book.
Well, you write a lot of scripts that never get done, but you got a lot of ideas that are sitting on a shelf somewhere or in a computer. And you say, well, this movie never got made, but maybe we can use this idea in a book. And that's sort of how it evolved.
Okay. And what was the collaborative process like?
A lot of fun.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I would basically write some stuff and send it off to Susan, and she would rewrite it and send it back to me.
Brian, as you can imagine, has a very visual imagination and a great eye for structure. And so he put down the tent poles, and then we'd send it back and forth. And we kind of played a game, which was send it back and forth and see if you can amuse the other person more than you were amused.
Did you have an ending from the start?
No, we were a couple of pages short, so...
What do you mean a couple of pages short?
As I recall, we wrote this sometime.
And?
I think there's a whole section that we decided to add on after we'd sort of mapped everything out.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
Was it the whole Paris section or something? Or do you mean, because it's very much an ensemble, or was it like one of the characters that you were following?
Well, we had some broad ideas.
It's first, this kind of attention to detail that makes Brian the mess.
Or, you know, we had the political story, and then when we got the DiCarlo character involved, then we got into her doing the column.
But I think the final revenge, I think we took the revenge up a notch there at the end.
Okay. What was the biggest challenge of writing together? Or, I guess, writing a novel, your first novel in general?
Well, as you can imagine, we had a lot of time together, and it sort of fills out the day because I sort of wake up very early in the morning, have all kinds of ideas, and I sort of go to the computer and write them down, and then I sort of confer with Susan, and sometimes I'm either developing a screenplay, but then I had all these other ideas that, from the other screenplays, and it's a kind of unique collaboration because Susan kind of fits into the things I don't have. You know, I'm, you know, a visual storyteller and blah, 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 blah. And she's able to, you know, give the characters meat on the bone. You know, in movies, you just say he, she, the reporter. You know, you're very sketching things in because when the actors come in, they give the body to the character. But Susan did a lot of this, filling in the characters and their backstories.
Well, the book came out a year ago. We're nearing the paperback release. Is there going to be a follow-up? Are there going to be more of these books?
Many, many more.
Yes, we, in our confinement, came up with another idea for a book, and we've been working on that for quite a while. So
it's finished.
Yes, it's finished.
That's great.
When our public calls out to us, we will release it.
Well, we'd love to see that for sure. I hope that happens.
Yeah, we're calling out for it.
I'm interested to know the book is, it feels so much like a Brian De Palma movie, but also has more. It feels like a lot of your movies are so, like, you know, laser focused in the narrative of, you know, a singular character or just a couple characters. This is much more of an ensemble. It almost, it's like a Brian De Palma movie by way of, like, Robert Altman, almost, with all these different characters. Was that always?
I'm proud to be the Robert Altman character in this portrayal.
Was that always the idea? And or did it start, you know, I know a lot of your movies and it's like sequences are where you start from and then build around. Was it more like that? Or was, you know, how did the whole thing begin for you?
What happens when you can't answer these questions?
You ask me.
Okay.
So Brian had a number of ideas, and the book is built around set pieces that are easily recognizable as trademark De Palma moments. The Eiffel Tower is one, and there are others. And so I think Brian plots things. He's a really good plotter. Like, he knows exactly how things are going to be structured and how different scenes are going to speak to other ones. So I think we started with his basic idea, structural idea, and then we played around with it a lot. Is that accurate?
You have to explain played around.
Well, we made up new characters and we complicated their stories and we, you know, twisted their pathways to one another.
And had many laughs doing it.
Susan, would you agree with the laughs part?
Yeah. I mean, writing with somebody takes all the, especially if somebody's Brian, takes all the loneliness of writing alone, removes that, and replaces it with, you know, a sense of mischief and play.
Right.
I really recommend it.
You have the right partner.
Were any of these set pieces left over from projects that you couldn't either fit into projects that were already completed or, you know, from abandoned projects as well?
Boy, that's hard to answer. I'm trying to think back.
Brian operates with a ragtag bag of tricks and ideas. I mean, he's always working. He has a million ideas. There's a treasure trove of unproduced scripts, and some are filled with good ideas, and some probably are filled with less good ideas.
They're all full with great ideas.
Did you send any early drafts or run any of the ideas by your buddy and neighbor, David Kep?
No, not really. I think we sent them. Because he read the book and gave us a quote. Yes, only when we were finished.
Okay.
Basically.
Okay.
Brian is very big on, here's a trade secret. He's very big on, don't show your work to anybody until it's finished.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. But you famously have chimed in on other people's work in progresses. Like, correct me if I'm wrong, but you really heckled Lucas on using the Force in that early Star Wars screening.
Will we never live down this meeting over the first screening of Star Wars? When I talked to everybody that was involved in that meeting, everyone has a different version of what happened.
Well, give your version.
Yeah.
But my version, my version is pretty close. I was just watching Stephen's biography they did of Stephen, and he related how he saw it. Everybody, you know, they always portray me as the guy that says the worst thing that drives everybody crazy. But if you're going to show me something, I'm going to tell you what I think about it. Why am I there unless I'm going to give an honest appraisal of what I've seen? And in this case, you know, the fact that Stephen says that only he saw the possibilities of Star Wars, that's not really true. We all saw it as a terrific thing that George had done. And we were well aware of where the special effects weren't there and how they had cut in all these planes from other movies to be things that they were supposed to be, you know, the ships and stuff like that. But I didn't make a joke about the Force. That's true.
tell us what your opinion of the Force was.
I just thought the idea of the Force is like, you know, the Force, I would say, but I kept repeating it, you know, like, it doesn't seem like a great name for this kind of spiritual guidance, the Force. So needless to say, I had a lot to say about the Force, which obviously I was terribly wrong about. But the other thing was that no one knew what was, you know, the movie starts in chapter 3. We're in a world nobody's ever knows anything about. He's got all these funny names for people. And I said, George, you've got to set this up somehow, like those crawls in the Flash Gordon movies where but George had that idea, but it was all gobbledygook, basically. So I and Jay Cox went over the crawl and basically rewrote it.
Right.
So it made some sense. And that was our contribution. But, I mean, I said some things very direct to my director friends about their movies that went on to be extremely successful. Sometimes I was right. Sometimes I was wrong. They did the same for my movies. I mean, when, I think when George saw Mission Impossible, you know, he said, there's no setup to this thing. You've got to set this thing up. You know, you got to set, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, and you're going to do that. You got to have that scene where they're all sitting around the table and everybody gets their instructions about what's going to happen. In the beginning, we had this very strange scene. I know it's hard for me to remember now, but with Void and somehow the jealous thing with the wife and Tom. And then we got into the first mission. And when George showed the movies, the first thing he said, what are these people doing? You know, this is Mission Impossible. It's a group of guys going to do something. So you've got to get them all around a table and tell the audience what they're supposed to do. And that's what we did. We went back and reshot it. So that was this example of, you know, us helping each other.
Wow.
And so is that scene with John Voight at the head of the table and Kristen Scott Thomas is off to the side, was she not able to come back for scheduling? Because it kind of seems like she was sort of isolated in a corner.
Correct. Astute student of cinema. That, in fact, Kristen could not come. So I had to shoot her over to the side and we doubled her in the master shot with her back to the window.
Wow.
I don't know if I can take credit. I think someone else pointed that out before me, but.
Go ahead, take credit.
I don't know if you know this, Brian, but we've done like over 150 episodes on the Mission Impossible franchise and talked to many of your collaborators on the first movie. And they told us everything. No, I'm kidding. So we were wondering, you know, that's the 25th anniversary now. And you had an interesting sort of history with writers on this one, too, which is why I'm glad Susan's here to hear about your relationship with other writers. But
no, I've heard this before.
What was that? I mean, did you use anything from that original Cats and Yuck draft of the movie, or was that just...
Which draft are you talking about?
Supposedly there was a draft that Willard and Gloria Katz did.
Correct.
And did you end up using anything from that? What happened was
Sidney Pollack worked with them originally. He worked on a year on a draft. It was all set in the Midwest. There was a storm. I don't even remember what it was. But Tom was unhappy with it. And when the head of CAA said to me, would you be interested in doing Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise? And I said, you bet. And they sent me off to, because Sidney wanted to do Sabrina. He wanted to get out of the Mission Impossible situation because it wasn't going well. So Sidney went on to Sabrina, and they plugged me into Mission Impossible. So I proceeded to work with the Hikes, who I knew way back from, you know, working with, you know, George many years ago. And we worked on a version still all set in the United States. I think and I don't quite remember what the mission was, but it had something to do with a storm. And I knew Tom was not going to like this. But I was forced to go through another draft of this thing where everybody was looking around for new writers to start all over again. And then Paramount had a commitment to Zalian. And Zalian and I went off to his office. We smoked a lot of cigarettes. I think we ate a lot of, I ate a lot of popcorn. And we worked for a couple of weeks. And we worked out a 10-page treatment of what ultimately became the basis for Mission Impossible. But then Zalian had other things he wanted to do, so he bailed out. And then I ran into David, who was about to do a remake of something. And I said, don't do that. Come over. Let's do Mission Impossible. So he said, great. So I handed David this 10-page treatment, and he and I worked out the initial script for Mission Impossible.
Okay.
That's act number one. Act number two is I'm trying to convince John. He's, you know, all Paramount wanted to do was make Mission Impossible. to get Tom Cruise into Mission Impossible is all they cared about. What the script was, who cares, as long as Tom is in Mission Impossible. And Tom was always having problems with the characters or something. And I said, Tom, you got to go in and tell Sherry that you're going to make this movie or, you know, we're going nowhere. So ultimately, Tom said, okay, we're going to make this script. And everybody said, good, we have a go picture. We're going to London. We're starting to build all the sets. But I got a call the next day, and it was from Paula Wagner. And she said, the good news is we're all go. The bad news is you have to fire David Koepp. I said, what? Because Tom wants to bring on Bob Tam. Fire David Koepp? David's never been fired in his life. He's an old friend of mine. And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no, that's what Tom wants to do. So I had to call up Dave. I said, Dave, the good news is it's a go. The bad news is you're fired.
Oh.
So what I did was keep David in the loop, let him know what we were doing when we were starting to go into production. And Town was up in the hotel for 6 weeks writing God knows what. Tom and I used to come in from rehearsals and act out these scenes in front of him. And he would work some more and smoke a few more cigars. And
are there any tapes of that?
I don't think so.
Acting out the scenes?
Finally, when he had to submit a script, the new script, Paula was appalled. I mean, it just didn't work at all. So I said, you've got to bring David Koepp back on, and we have to take some of the good stuff some of the good scenes that Town done. And so what Town did, he rewrote the whole script. That's not what needed to be done. The characters had to be fleshed out a little bit, and there have to be some clever lines. That's what he did. And then I brought David back on. I made them pay him a lot of money. And for 2 weeks, he took what Towns had done and integrated into his script. And that became the script we shot with, of course, until the famous story about pulling off masks in the boxcar, which we had a big fight over that. And I said, I got this big helicopter chase in the tunnel with him on the train. Void on the helicopter, and then Town looks at me and says, oh, one of those, you know, helicopters going into a tunnel sequences. And I said, oh, okay, maybe you're right. Let's do pulling off masks in the boxcar. That's how we'll wrap it up. Great. And I left it at that. I walked out of the room, and Tom came around and thought that maybe the helicopter thing in the end would be better than the pulling the masks off in the boxcar as a finale.
So how much of the Town stuff ultimately made it in, would you say? Not much?
There were some good lines. There's some good Town lines in there, but basically it's David's script.
Okay.
And I was very disappointed with Town, with what, you know, he has such a great reputation. I was very disappointed in what he did. And then look what he did to the next Mission Impossible. It's a mess.
It's true.
That is the no good.
He was riffing on Hitchcock, though. I mean, did you have any sympathy in that?
What, you mean in the one he did after mine?
Yeah, it's kind of notorious.
It's basically just Notorious.
Yeah, I know. I heard that idea so many times. Let's do Notorious. Blah-dy, blah-dy, blah. And that's what he did. And it was not good.
Wait, when you say you heard that idea so many times, do you mean Tom Cruise was saying to you, let's do Notorious?
No. This was an idea that Town had about doing a kind of the Notorious element.
Oh, okay.
We all love Notorious, but it didn't work for Mission Impossible, as you probably observed.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more from Brian De Palma and Susan Lehman after the break.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
You know, the sequence in the diner with John Voight when he's revealed to be alive and Tom Cruise is seeing the truth while John Voight lies. You know, I think Paul Hirsch had some hilarious comments about how critics were dumbed down from Twister coming out a couple weeks before he told us about that. But I'm wondering where that sequence is so brilliant and I just love it so much. I'm wondering when did that come about? Was that with Kep or was that, you know, when in the process?
Now you're getting into an area that I don't quite remember. I remember the way I shot it and the idea of, I think it must have come from me and David, because I had this idea that Voight should be saying one thing and Tom should be thinking what the truth was. And then, you know, I laid out the sequence like that. But I think that's something we had right in the beginning of the script. I guess you could check in the versions David has on his website.
Yes.
The initial script and then how it changed in the final.
I think those are all included in the De Palma archive, by the way.
No, they're in the David Kep archive.
In one of his earlier scripts, there was a great set piece with a military wedding where, you know, Ethan is tricking Kittredge by showing up and he does a quick change of his outfit to like fit in with this whole military wedding that comes out of the church. Do you recall that?
No. We had a great sequence where they got one of the members. I think it was...
Fing Rames?
Was it Bing? I think it was Bing, where he's in prison and they break him out in prison. We had a great sequence with breaking him out of prison, in which they give him a shot so he looks like he's dead, and then they bring him up to the roof, and they're going to incinerate him, and then the helicopter arrives and saves Ving, you know, from being incinerated, and he becomes... Otherwise, we had the Seven Samurai recruiting the group.
Right.
We kind of lost all that. We just stuck them all in the train, and they were all there, but we had sequences for each one where they were recruited.
But that was never filmed, was it?
No.
Right.
Though I laid out that sequence of the escape from prison. We were even starting to build a set for that before we said, this is too much, it's too expensive. You know, we got to cut this down.
Wow. But you seem to have had a relatively good time on this movie, all things considered, correct?
A good time?
Hindsight is making it. Yeah, I've heard you talk very warmly about the movie recently. I don't know if maybe time has colored your perception of it, but
a good time.
You made a comment recently about how Carlito's Way and Mission Impossible might be... I forget the exact phrasing that you said, but it was something about you being at the top of your game. You had the biggest, you know, sandbox to play in, and
I had all the great things that you have when you make a big studio movie, you know, all the great technicians, all a lot of money, you know, big stars. Yeah. You know, you can make something extraordinary. But it was like after it was over, I said, get me out of here. Talk about stress in order to get the thing done.
Right. Well, you've flirted with sequels or prequels to Untouchables and Scarface in the past. Did you ever feel like you wanted to return to Mission Impossible? And what was it about those projects that sort of were more tempting than another Mission Impossible?
Well, we did. Art Linson and I worked on a prequel to The Untouchables, but it was a whole different story. It's not, you know, this continuation. These are all, it was all done with these characters who are a lot younger. Mission Impossible, I mean, once is enough. That's what I always felt. I mean, when Tom asked me to do the next one, I said, Are you kidding? One of these is enough. I mean, the fact that he goes on making them, it's like, ay. Guys, love them all. You've been watching each one with new excitement.
Yes,
it's true. Have you watched the rest of them?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I guess the third one was pretty good, but that's because it had Philip Seymour Hoffman in it.
Yeah.
He was fantastic. And then the rest of them just old blur. Please, no more motorcycles. And
what about the sequence on Dubai on the Burj Khalifa? You see that sequence?
Is that there's one where he's running over roofs that goes on forever. When's that?
That was the most recent one. That was Fallout.
It's like, stop running, Tom.
He can't. He cannot stop running.
Never. He'll never stop.
He'll not stop running. Get another rooftop to run across.
I wanted to ask you about the music. There was obviously, you know, Paul Hirsch told us the story of
Alan
Silvestri.
Easy.
You're getting attacked by your dog, it looks like.
By the dog.
So the music, obviously, you know, Alan Silvestri was on and then was taken off. And then Danny Elfman came on. And you've worked with so many incredible composers in your career. I would love to hear how that whole process went down. And then also would love to know why never again with Elfman, because the two of you seem like a match made in heaven.
Well, you know, the great composers, the problem is, you know, they're not always available because they're working all the time. With Alan, it was just, we were recording and it just didn't work. And, you know, Tom was very unhappy with it. And I was, you know, I'm very used to, you know, working with composers and going in and changing this and moving this around. And it just, there was no sort of chemistry between Alan and I. And when we saw that Danny was available, we immediately snapped him up. And I, as Paul, I know has detailed, explained to you, I mean, I literally spent, you know, 4 weeks sitting next to him going over every cue in Mission Impossible in order to get us ready to record in 4 weeks. And he did an amazing job.
So you wanted to work with him again?
Who?
Danny.
Oh, of course. I mean, yeah. I've worked with all the great composers. I've missed a few, but, you know, I started with Bernard Herrmann, so.
Not too shabby.
Yeah, you can't start any better, basically.
There was a De Palma retrospective in France. They started with Casualties of War. And when Brian went on stage, he was crying.
Yeah, he said,
that score always makes me cry. So in front of an audience of thousands of people standing up and clapping, Brian is wiping the tears off.
Is that your favorite score?
Yeah, it's a great score. It's one of the greatest scores.
Yeah.
The Mission is also a great score.
It is. It is. And I think Alan Silvestri used that music he wrote for your movie for another movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Eraser, the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I don't think it's something maybe that you'd never saw.
I'll have to watch that and see if I can remember what it...
Yeah, let us know if that's true.
There was originally there was a train sequence for The Untouchables before the, you know, Odessa Steps famous sequence. There was I think that David Mamet wrote, we actually found the pages of this original train chase. Was that, what was the reason for not doing that? And then was that kind of carried over into Mission?
Well, the reason was we couldn't afford it. I mean, you know, the studio said, no, you know, trains, a train chase, forget it. And then Art went to meet with Mamet to try him to write, get him to write something out. And Mamet was just starting to shoot his first movie. And he said, go away. So Art had flown all the way to meet Mamet somewhere where he was shooting. And Mamet, in his usual cordial manner, said, go away. Can't be bothered with this. So I said, well, look, it's about getting the accountant. And needless to say, I, you know, the baby carriage on the steps sort of was the thing that started me thinking about having this shootout in the train station. And I sent Eric Schwab around. I said, get me a staircase. And then we literally went in and shot like, I think, six nights. And I just made it up as we were there.
Were there no script pages?
No. I just made it up, basically.
Wow.
I don't know if we wrote anything down. I don't remember. But I just remember. And we sort of did it in sequence, so it was easy to...
Wait, you mean you just had a carriage and the steps and no script?
No, I had the Odessa steps in my mind. And then I had Elliot in the midst of, a baby carriage going down the steps and a gunplay going back and forth. That was the basic idea.
So did you have storyboards or anything, or was it just going as just shot by shot, just build it out yourself?
I just did it.
Wow.
Because what's great about that sequence is that, I'm always talking about you have to lay out the choreography. Everybody has to know where things are before you start shooting people. And the staircase is such a, it's like a football field or something. You know where everything is. The clock's up there. The steps go down here. People come from the outside into the station from here. What's important is you have to take a tremendous amount of time and keep the audience engaged of setting up the choreography. And of course, the master of this is Hitchcock in the crop duster scene, where you see him very carefully lay out the choreography in the slowest of ways, but he keeps you entertained enough so you hang in there with him. And that's the same really with that Odessa step sequence. I might add, when David Mamet saw the movie, as soon as the sequence started, he walked out of the screening room.
Really?
And when the sequence was over, he returned.
Oh, God. Wow.
First, you had that crazy baby carriage on the step sequence, which I see, as far as he's concerned, I seem to have ruined his vision.
Right. And what is the scene that's always included in every kind of montage of your kind of greatest hits, that baby carriage sequence? It must drive him crazy.
That would be a hard thing to do.
Do you remember, I don't want to use the word blackmail, but coercing David Knoll into giving you an extra shot, visual effects
John
shot,
Knoll.
John Knoll, to give him his VFX supervisor credit on the movie?
Say that again?
John Knoll told us a story that you said that he could have a credit, I believe it was visual effects supervisor, only if he did an extra shot for you of John Voight in the plane at the beginning of the movie. Do you remember this at all?
No.
Okay.
But I would believe John.
Okay. Okay.
Is that something you would do?
Are you kidding? Why not? You need the shot.
Did he work on Snake Eyes on the?
Yes.
Okay. I've always been fascinated about that ending, and I'm so glad that you put some footage of it in the documentary. But yeah, do you think that the lack of that ending hurt the movie, or what's your sort of feeling on it?
My concept and David's concept was, this is like the Great Flood. I mean, when you're dealing with such a corrupt universe, the only way to deal with it is to a flood. You got to kill everybody.
Yeah.
And that was always the concept. But we discovered that audiences don't believe in God coming down and creating the flood when there's such rampant evil around. So then we had to come up with a different ending, which I don't think is as effective. But that's basically because our conception of how it should have ended, we were never able to do. And the audience would never accept, basically.
Well, how dependent are you on those test audience responses? I mean, did you have anything like that in Mission? And was it sort of freeing writing this book because you didn't have to? I mean, you had to show it. To, I mean, you and Susan talked about it. But
yes. I mean, you're always dealing with that research group. And believe me, in my history, I had all the movies, it had all the language, all the eroticism in them, and I'd be constantly fighting with these people that would, poll the audience. And because anything really excessive, an audience reacts very strongly to, and the studio always with the studio when they would get kind of negative cards after a screening.
Right.
One reason that we started working on this book is because Brian had been involved in HBO production of Paterno. And then he'd get, you know, a million notes and he said, let's just write a book. It's much easier. You don't have to take these phone calls or read these crazy notes.
Yeah. Thousands of notes about Paterno.
And so was that more notes than you'd ever had before? Was it getting worse?
Absolutely. You get piles of notes, you know, and I said, I've had it, basically, you know, and I just walked away.
Wow.
Thank you, Lucia.
We'll be back with more from Brian De Palma and Susan Lehman after the break.
I mean, do you feel like the medium of fiction is sort of going to be your outlet for the next little while, or are you itching to get back?
Well, until I become senile, one's mind tends to be working all the time, and I'm, you know, trying to make maybe one more movie, if possible, maybe another. And of course, writing books is, you know, a lot of fun that Susan and I do together.
Right. Susan, do you have a favorite Brian De Palma movie?
Yes, Casualties of War left me speechless.
Wow. Not the easiest watch.
No, but I think it's the least credited. You know, that's not the first movie most people say, but it has a power unlike anything I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Right. I'm assuming you would never be able to make something like that again. Well, Redacted is sort of like a sort of spiritual.
You'd make a movie like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of a, but that is much smaller scale, I would say, right? Like, you would never be able to sell that to Columbia in 2021, probably.
It's a whole different world now because you're dealing with the big streaming services. People seem to like, you know, things in 6 or 7 parts, like serials.
Right.
You know, the 2-hour movie is sort of based on the 3-act play. But I think the culture has sort of lost sight of that. And whether that format is going to remain, I wonder about. It's like the look of movies has changed quite a bit because of the digital revolution.
Right.
You know, the beauty, you know, I keep on saying, why is there no beauty in cinema anymore? Because they don't light the way they used to. You know, when you're dealing with digital stuff, you just have to, you know, turn on a lamp, you know, and it's lit. And you can do really things really fast. But, you know, if you want something to be really beautiful, you have to take the time to light it correctly. And they just don't do that anymore. Very few directors do.
Would you ever consider doing a miniseries? Does that interest you at all?
Well, I am working on a series Susan and I quite like A French Village, the French series, which, you know, is about a village during World War II. And the guy that produced and wrote that series, you know, when we were in France promoting our book, had an idea of doing the same thing in America during the Civil War in one town. So we started to work on it, and we sort of got slowed down because of the virus. But no, we, you know, worked on it's like a 10-part series. We worked on developing it, and we were going to continue developing it once he is able to come over here and work again with me.
Oh, wow.
It's about, Brian said it so quickly, but it's about a town that's occupied by the North and the South during the Civil War. And it follows the framework of this terrific French series, which is about a village in France that during the Nazi occupation.
Oh, wow.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that that Arsenic's Necessary would make a great kind of 6-part Netflix thing.
Absolutely.
That had occurred to me as well.
Would you do it as a miniseries or a TV show?
Write the check. We'll be there.
Your last big kind of Hollywood production was a giant Disney movie based on a theme park attraction. Was that sort of it for you? What did you kind of take away from that experience?
You're talking about Mission to Mars?
Yes.
Well, I came into that picture because the other director left, the guy that did all the Johnny Depp pirate pictures.
Oh, Gore Verbinski. Okay.
Yeah, Gore Verbinski. He was doing it, but he had a budget of $130 million, and they wouldn't make it for that. So they said, could I do it for like $110 million? I said, sure. And I'd never done a science fiction movie like that before. This whole thing sort of fascinated me. But making movies like that is an endless struggle with thousands of special effects shops, you know, getting the shots right and constantly dealing with the studio because the shots are so expensive. And they're constantly saying, do you really need this? Do you really need that? And of course, the other problem is that the head of the studio changed. So the person that initiated the project isn't there. You know, the new regime's not really cares about it that much. And you basically have to struggle through the whole thing. And you don't get everything you would need in order to make it as effective as it could be. And that's when I said, I can't do this anymore. And I went and moved to Paris.
Wow. Well, there are parts of that movie, parts of those sets that are now in Walt Disney World, which I don't picture you as someone who would visit Walt Disney World. But if you're ever down there, go to Epcot and you can see pieces of Mission to Mars there.
You're kidding.
No, in the queue for, and Sinise recorded a pre-show for a ride in his kind of Mission to Mars character. So,
oh boy. You know,
yeah.
That's something we can't miss, honey.
Susan has been looking to get down to Orlando. I can see it in her eyes. So, yeah.
Yeah. Take the dogs to Orlando.
Yeah, take the dogs to Orlando, please.
Get the dogs and the cat into the van and let's go.
How important was your collaboration with Stephen Burham? You know, he obviously shot so many of the movies we talked about today.
He's a great cinematographer. I mean, he's fabulous. You know, he's retired now, right?
Oh, wait, we're trying to get a hold of him. We'd love to talk to him on the show. So, yeah, we haven't been able to find him. Paul Hirsch hasn't gotten us his number.
Yeah. No, he was fantastic. It all started with Body Double.
One of my favorites of yours. I think another underappreciated gem, like Casualties of War, that not too many people talk about. But I was looking for parking one day and pulled into that shopping center and said, oh my God, is this the shopping center from Body Double? And and the kid, the valet kid, was like, you know, we hear that a lot. So, yeah.
So Paul Hirsch is not so hot on Blowout, which is befuddling to us because we love Blowout so much. What are your thoughts on Blowout? Because I know it had some changes while it was being made. Are you happy with it?
Oh, yeah, I'm very happy with it. I don't quite understand what Paul is bothered by. But Paul, as you know, is very bright and very opinionated.
Yes.
Not afraid to state his opinions, and they're always good to hear. But no, I really, really liked Blowout. It really was the movie I wanted to make. And I had the resources to do it.
Would you say that about most of your movies?
No, I wouldn't.
So is it not that many that you felt like you had the resources for?
No. The question that I was asking was it the movie you set out to make?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So how many of the movies you made were what you set out to make?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I'm pretty satisfied with most of them, except for examples like Mission to Mars, where I couldn't make the ending work because I didn't have enough power to get enough special effects to make it, you know, really moving. And
Domino?
Well, Domino is a whole other story.
I liked Domino, but...
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, it's underappreciated.
I think so, too. It's got a great score. There's some really fun sequences, I thought. But I know that you were never able to finish that one, basically, right?
Well, not really. It's just that, as I have said many times, I was there 100 days and shot 30. So I just, you know, the money kept on falling out, and I kept on being left in hotel suites waiting for the money to come in. And after waiting a couple of weeks and nothing happening, I said, that's it, guys, I'm going home. And my assistant director, Eric Schwab, went to Sicily where they got some more money to shoot the sequence where the exterior of the bullring, where they drive up and then go into the adjacent building. Mm-hmm. And then I put, you know, I laid it out. The storyboards. Eric is a fantastic director, and he just, you know, did exactly as I set out. And I had to fight with the company a lot with, you know, getting people paid. The question was, did you get paid? And I had a lot of loyal people working for me, and I'd always ask them, did they pay you? And a lot of times they hadn't. And it was a struggle right to the end. And then when it was finished, you know, some festivals wanted to show it, and I said, no, I'm not going to support this. You've given me such a terrible time. So that was a sort of a sad ending.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Paul told us about another incomplete De Palma masterwork, which was you videotaping his wedding.
Oh, yeah. That's true. I shot 10 reels, 9 of which were black. Somehow I left the, you know, those cameras have a kind of variable shutter, and which meant that the first 9 reels were underexposed, so it was completely black. And then the final reel I got.
Well, he's still married, so I think, you know, whatever you did, it worked well. I know we are long. Is there anything that you and Susan can tease about this next book? I don't want to get you in trouble, obviously. Susan will be the arbiter of this, but...
Why don't you describe Carrier to them?
We took Emile Zola's novel, Therese Racan, and we put a modern American hex on it.
Okay.
And in our version, it's not Therese, but it's Terry in Toledo. And it has a lot of intrigue and De Palma special effects.
Okay.
It's also, you're playing they're making the movie of Terry. So the triangle that exists in Therese Racan is reflected in the actors and director that are making the movie.
Okay.
Don't miss it.
Come into your local bookstall.
Okay. Well, we hope that we can talk to you when that comes out, or whatever else you want to talk about. We are always available. And this was such a huge thrill. Seriously, we've been trying to do this for, like, I think since the book came out in hardcover. So it's been amazing. And we love the book. We love all of your work, obviously, Brian. So this was really a huge thrill. So thank you so much for taking the time.
You know, okay. If when you listen to your tape, you need anything else, let us know. I mean,
yes, I'm going
to talk to you, and you guys clearly know what you're doing. And if you need any, you know, comment on something from Brian about any movie.
Honey, it's time to leave.
Oh, shut up.
Brian is done with us. Susan, we'll talk more. But yes, okay, thank you.
No, I meant if you need anything from him, let me know.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
This was amazing. Thank you.
Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, is produced by Charles Hood. That's me, and Drew Taylor. Our supervising producer is Abby Smith. This episode was edited by Luke Burson, with music by Kevin Blumenfeld. The interview is a production of Bravo Echo 11 LLC, and the podcast is a production of Paramount Pictures. All rights are reserved. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.